Welcome to the Remarkable Retail Podcast, Season 5, Episode 22, presented by Marketile. I'm Michael LeBlanc.
And I'm Steve Dennis.
Steve, do you remember the first time you went to New York City, like Manhattan? I think you were born in that region, but do you remember the first time you like crossed a bridge and went into the big city?
Don't specifically, but yes, I was. My family lived in Queens, and though I was actually born in a hospital in Orange, New Jersey, fun fact. Mm. My dad worked in Manhattan, and I probably went in to go visit him.
I tell you, up here in Canada, I watched, you know, born in Ottawa, moved to Toronto. You'd see New York so much in media and television and movies. I was dying to go there, and eventually I went in my early 20s, and that was, the taxi driver New York, right? That was, right. You didn't want to lean on anything because it was probably just peed on kind of New York.
Painting a vivid picture, Michael.
Yeah, what a different city. I mean, and of course, why are we talking about this? Because we'll be together in the Big Apple coming up at the NRF show on Monday, January 16th, presented by our friends at Marketile with Container Stores, Gretchen Gans, you and I. And I think you're doing a book signing as well. So we just want to make sure that people connect and know we're going to be there.
Yeah, we're doing a talk called Shift Happens, Choose Remarkable or Irrelevance. And we'll be I'll be sharing some ideas from my book and some other stuff. And Gretchen will be talking about all the cool things they're doing at the Container Store. And then we'll have some books to give away and to sign. So make sure you plan for that.
All right. Well, we'll look forward to seeing everybody there, and it'd be wonderful to be back at the show. Now, about this episode, we got a solo episode. A really fun solo episode coming up for the people. An episode dedicated to grading yourself on your January 2022 10 no holds barred predictions for retail in 2022, the ranking. So we put you to task, so to speak, in this episode.
Yeah. I don't generally consider myself a futurist, but one of the things I've noticed about people who call themselves futurists is they don't do short-term predictions. I'm sure you can find an exception. But then they'll put things in, books or speeches or whatever about things that are going to happen at an indeterminate time in the future. And honestly, for me, from an accountability standpoint, that might have been the smarter move. But anyway, you'll have to stay tuned to see the errors of my ways, as well as a few things that I think I got right.
All right. Well, let's get to news of the week. So let's tap on a quick macro. We got some great job numbers coming out. Continued strength, which is good news and bad news, I suppose. Off mic, we were talking about how hard it is to find people, and people ghosting and interviews and just walking away from stores and not even telling you they don't work there anymore.
Well, we got a couple things in the U.S. anyway. I know that the situation in Europe and some other markets is not as strong, but the GDP numbers were surprisingly strong. People keep saying, we're in a recession, and yet we've had a couple quarters now of positive growth. Mm-hmm. On the low side, for sure, but still positive. As you mentioned, while we have seen some of these high-profile tech layoffs, some other companies announcing big layoffs, the overall job market is really still pretty strong. Jobless claims, unemployment continue to be in pretty good shape. Mm. We did get some positive news, or at least positive indication, that perhaps inflation is tempering a bit. And then one of the things which I hadn't been focused that much on, other than I drive by and see what the gas prices have been, gas prices this past week are actually lower than they were before the Ukrainian war.
I interviewed the deputy chief economist for a big bank here, CIBC, and he called the recession a wannabe recession. Never seen anything like it, because you've got full employment, yet you've got recessionary winds blowing. So it's a real different time. So I'm sure it'll be something we'll talk about now and in the future. Let's talk about any other comments about it's kind of in the rearview mirror now. We're in the after party, so to speak, Black Friday, Cyber Monday. There's some data coming out. Any comments on the data that you've been seeing and reading?
Well, I think overall it paints a picture of a pretty tepid cyber week, I guess you could say. I know our friends at Salesforce reported that global e-commerce sales were only up about 2%. And I think we're generally, COVID kind of messed up the extremes here in terms of percentage growth, but, you know, kind of the long-term trend had been that e-commerce was growing, you know, 13-14% every year. And so, you know, I would always joke around when people would say, oh, it's a record year this year. Like, well, yeah, it's been a record year since 1993. Yeah, it's not really big news.
Every year. $7.
Yeah. Other people were kind of focused on the fact, or the at least the estimates, that store traffic was up quite a bit year over year. I don't know that that's terribly surprising, given that we are now comparing, if people even remember this, but we were starting to see the big Omicron spike. Yeah. And I think that definitely tempered traffic.
That was the big NRF story of all, right? What was the numbers like? Marked a new record 5-day period, exceeded 166 million projections they gave for Cyber. So they really hung their hat on traffic this year, which is interesting.
Yeah, and of course, traffic doesn't necessarily result in sales. So another report, and you know, the problem here is the data sources are mostly from surveys, or in the case of, say, MasterCard's data, it's from, you know, their cardholder data. So it's indicative, but, you know, we don't really know how things sort out until we kind of get the, you know, the individual retailers reporting their specifics. But the NPD data showed that on a dollar volume for Cyber Week, sales were down compared to last year. But the other thing they did that I thought was interesting was they were comparing it to 2019, so the pre-COVID period. And they had sales down compared to 2019 by 9% on a dollar basis. And then even more interesting, I think, is when you look at it, because, you know, we've been talking about how inflation is affecting, you know, has a component of what that sales volume looks like. But if you do it on a unit volume basis, their data shows that transactions, or excuse me, units sold were down by 19% compared to 2019 and down 8% to 2021. So to the extent you believe that that's a reasonably accurate picture, I would say Cyber Week is pretty disappointing. Now, what we touched on that last week, and I guess I'll just kind of wrap up with this, I do think, number one, Cyber Week is not the whole holiday season.
Marathon,
because of Thanksgiving occurring earlier, relatively speaking, than it did last year, there are more shopping days ahead. So here we are recording this on Friday, and at least if you celebrate the Christmas holidays, you still have, what, 22 days to shop. So there's still a lot that can happen. I guess one other thing, I lied there, I was going to wrap up, but the other thing that I thought was interesting to look at is the degree of discounts. And most of the reports I saw that discounting was heavier this year by a pretty good amount than last year, which makes sense if you think about last year, we're kind of in this position of inventory scarcity, and this year we're into abundance or glut, depending upon where you sit.
Yeah, you were chasing inventory more than you were chasing sales this time last year. I think consumers are playing a game of discount chicken with retailers. They're like, okay, we hear you. You hear you got lots of stuff, so we're just going to wait it out until like the 24th. Again, if you're buying for Christmas. So I think there's a lot of that going on.
I will say, and this is very anecdotal information, but the sheer number of emails that I have gotten with promotional offers is just staggering. And, you know, I unsubscribe from stuff and whatever, so I don't have like a, and I don't keep track of this year over year, but I just felt like a desperation starting to creep into some of these emails as we got into the latter part of Cyber Monday in particular.
Let's talk about earnings. Ulta raised their forecast on strong beauty sales. We've had the CEO of Ulta on kicking off our season. What make you of the Ulta earnings?
Well, incredibly impressive. I mean, not only did they raise their guidance, we've talked about a bunch of retailers that have lowered their guidance or basically said, we have no clue what's going to happen. So this is a bit of an outlier. But a 14.6% comp. You don't hear that too often. And a 27.5% rise in net income on what has already been a pretty good string of performance. And I guess my comment, I mean, as you said, we had Dave Kimball on. Ulta is a retailer that I showcase as a remarkable retailer in my book. So I just think they seem to be firing on all cylinders. Is probably a bit of a lift from kind of people going back out more and, you know, those kinds of things. So there's that. But if you think about Ulta as well, you know, they're in so many markets now. You know, this is a business, the beauty business, which is one of these businesses that is, as you well know, mm-hmm. used to be really kind of a cornerstone of the traditional department stores.
Yeah.
So you think about, you know, with Ulta, with Sephora, Bluemercury, you know, a few of the smaller players, there's been such a shift over the past decade away from those traditional players largely on the mall to mm-hmm. to these more convenience-oriented, more focused mm-hmm. competitions. So I think that's just a something for people to think about more, you know, whether in the beauty business or not, just think about more holistically mm-hmm. as to, you know, what is that about that allows these companies to have great success.
Now, I saw a name from your connected to your past, Lands End, put out some results that weren't stellar. What did you make of those?
Yeah, so Lands End, I often use, you know, we talk about all these digitally native vertical brands, and, you know, I often talk about Lands End as an analog native vertical brand because they, mm-hmm. you know, historically have been a pretty successful direct-to-consumer brand, and they've had kind of a sordid history, perhaps, but they had been doing better.
Charitable, by the way, but okay.
Yeah, they had been doing better, it seemed, but Wall Street was surprised that they had swung to a loss. They took their outlook down, and I just decided to check because people will hear in just a few minutes. We talk about some other stock performance in the main part of this show segment, but their stock's down 60% year to date, which is not exactly fantastic. Mm-hmm. But you know, a lot of retailer stocks
are
quite a bit. But but they're struggling. And then you know, just to go back to our wobbly unicorn corner, Farfetch. Oh, there we go.
Here we go.
Steve, wait for the sound effects.
Yeah.
Once again, our rehearsals.
We rehearse over and over again.
And then I step on my line or step on your line. Anyway, Farfetch, which is a mostly online fashion brand, which was flying pretty high for a number of years. They really, what's the nice expression? they had a bad week.
There's no bed involved. Is there a bed involved?
There's no bed, right. It's an expression that perhaps involves a bed. You could do your own research.
Left better on set on our family.
Yes. Well, you know, when you have a unicorn in your bed, things are going to happen. They were flying high and kind of crashed back down to earth based upon some guidance that they gave, and their earnings were not good. So it's I guess, you know, when I step back, not just only on this set of earnings, mm-hmm. but some of the ones we've been discussing over the last few weeks, it's really continued reevaluation of some of these high flying, you know, quote unquote disruptor business models. But on the other hand, brands like Tractor Supply, Ulta, some others that have this really powerful business model, even though they've been around for a while, like they're not new,
bringing in good numbers.
new brands, continue to deliver. So even in this shaky economy or uncertain economy, it's possible to put up some pretty good numbers if you've got a remarkable business strategy and you execute it well.
Well, speaking of some remarkable numbers, I guess, Claire's is opening up 21 Macy's stores. Is that remarkable? Is this filling up space? What's, you know, Claire's a nice young brand. I mean, I guess that it makes sense. It's a youth-oriented brand. I guess it's a JCPenney play that you get to the youth. But what do you make of that?
Well, I just want to know, are they next to the Wetzel's Pretzels outpost? Because I feel like we reported on that a while back, and I haven't heard anything about it. I don't know. I mean, I sometimes feel, well, first of all, sometimes I feel like I'm just piling on with my complaints about Macy's. That's fair criticism.
What do the kids call it? Dog piling? We're not the
dog piling. Yeah. But it does feel like they are just trying stuff because they have the space and because they have a broad strategic desire to, you know, just like with toys, the Toys R Us, you know, just get that younger customer, get a slightly different customer. And at one level, it's fine. But I'm still going back to, like, what is this cohesive strategy to really go? So great to try stuff. But I feel like too much of it is motivated by, we've got these massive stores. We've got thousands of square feet that are producing under $100 a square foot. What else can we put in it? It feels a little bit desperate. And I should point out, I'm pretty sure Claire's has already got a big presence at Walmart. So it's not like they don't have kind of a shop-in-a-shop wholesale kind of relationship already. So I'm not sure how additive this could be.
Let's end today talking about our friends at Amazon. We haven't talked about them in a while. So I'm sure they're feeling lonely.
Whatever happened to those guys?
So we've seen some price data from Profiterito?
That's a good question. I say Profiterol because those are delicious, but I don't think that's their name. Profitero, I think.
Anyway, we're seeing some price information from a company which we can't pronounce that's talking about Amazon prices. What have you learned?
Well, I saw this, and I also saw some other data that points to how Amazon is very consistently materially cheaper than some other large discounters like Walmart, like Target, like others. And one of the things that I just wondered about, particularly since it seems like Andy Jassy is focused on improving the profitability of Amazon more broadly, but in particular, given the underperformance in retail, it just seems to me like there's got to be an opportunity for Amazon to selectively raise some prices on a fair number of items. And I think it would be a layup to add, 50 basis points, 75 basis points to their gross margin, which is a huge amount of money on the scale of their business.
On their turns, for sure.
Yeah, and it's something that presumably they could test their way into as well. So I've been aware, because I've seen other reports on this pricing difference, because, some Wall Street firms and others do this bundle, basket analysis, and I've just noticed how consistently there's some really, really huge differences. And I guess it's not clear to me why you need to be 16% cheaper, for example, as their study pointed out, than Target on some items. Like, couldn't you be 5% cheaper? still be the price leader? And, generally speaking, Target and Walmart have pretty sharp prices. So it'll be interesting seeing strategic. I guess the reason I bring it up is it seems like it's a real opportunity for Amazon to improve their profitability. And it'll just be interesting to see, this is kind of merchandise 101, right? And while you're always looking for opportunities, to optimize your pricing and your inventory turnover and your, as well as, obviously there's a strategic branding part of how you want to, be forward in the market. But it seems like they've been leaving a lot of money on the table potentially for years.
Well, I think it's going to be an interesting year ahead for many retailers, including Amazon. So with that note, let's take a look back at your predictions and let's get the chalkboard out and let's see how you did. All right, Steve, let's get on to this fun segment where we're going to take a look at your 10 no-holds-barred predictions for retail in 2022. You're a no-bullshit guy, so let's take the opportunity to see how you did. And we're going to give ourselves, or you're going to give yourselves, a grade. Like, we're taking you back to school here, A through F, I guess A plus through F. So I'm going to call out your 10 predictions that you made back in January. You even had an article in Forbes.
Yeah.
And we're going to see how you did. We're closing in on the end of the year. So
to be fair, we should probably just put this out as a little bit of a disclaimer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's possible things could radically change in the next 3 weeks. So I'm just going to put that out there. We are doing this a little bit early, but I think I'm going to be able to stick with these grades.
I think the lawyers call that a caveat. So we just put a caveat in there. The stores strike back again, your number one prediction.
Yeah, so I talked about this in my book, and I also wrote something about the stores striking back, two or three years ago, because as we've talked about a bunch of times, there was this whole retail apocalypse narrative, which I thought was kind of nonsense. And people want to keep thinking that e-commerce is going to take over the world. And so this prediction was basically about, well, not so fast. Mm-hmm. Stores are going to continue to be important. And in some ways, not always, but in some ways, they're even more important when it comes to things like buy online, pick up in store, or return to store. And so that was what this was about. Yeah. So, this one, I think I would give myself a pretty solid A. I mean, when you look at number one, e-commerce growth has flattened. Physical store growth from a sales perspective has been quite strong. Lots of stores still opening. I believe, according to our friends at CoreSite, twice as many stores opened as have closed so far this year. Many of the digitally native vertical brands, so-called digitally native vertical brands, continue to open a lot of stores. Warby Parker talked about getting up to several hundred stores. So that's a little bit of irony there. And specific to what we talked about with Target, the hybrid role of the stores, so the role of stores in fulfillment, is becoming even more important. There's quite a lot of investment there, not just from Target, but Walmart and a bunch of others. So I feel pretty good about this prediction. You can keep talking about the sky is falling for physical stores, but facts are stubborn things.
Facts are stubborn things. And I think it reminds me of one of your best social media tweets when Facebook announced they were opening a store to sell the metaverse. Irony's dead. So there you go.
It's officially died.
Another proof point. So I'm going to put you up on the chalkboard. A. You got an A. So there you go. Let's go on to number two.
Maybe tough to maintain, but we'll see.
All right. Do you like that chalkboard sound? It's a little fun there for the people.
I love the sound effects.
A little fun for the people.
It's like retail AMS. What's that called? ASMR? Whatever.
Sorry. Here, let me play that again. All right.
I'm too relaxed to go forward.
Yeah, either that or we've lost half the audience. Going number two, moderate department stores will experience a dead cat bounce. Now, first of all, what is, for those who may not know, what is a dead cat bounce?
Well, I don't like to use violent imagery. You can kind of picture, you know, if you were to drop a dead cat, mm-hmm. wouldn't bounce.
They tend to be pretty
much.
Stiff. Yeah, they tend to be pretty stiff.
Yeah. So it's this idea that they don't really stay up in the air.
Yeah, they don't bounce several times. They bounce once and then
pretty
not
much.
That I've had the experience myself.
I mean, your results may vary, but but yeah, there was a lot of talk early in the year, and we're not going to call anybody out, but if you were to Google things like department stores are back or department store resurrection or these sort of things, you will see quite a lot of people who frankly should know better who were predicting that department stores are going to have this big resurgence. And I just never thought that was likely, mainly because the problems of the department store sector are, you know, two decades old. And I didn't see anything that was really fundamentally going to change that trajectory. So here, I think, again, I would give myself an A. If you mm-hmm. look at the performance of the four major department stores, so Macy's, Kohl's, Dillard's, and Penney's, Macy's sales basically flat, year-to-date profits down. Kohl's sales down 7 or 8%, I think. Profits down 60%. Dillard's, a little bit better. Their sales are actually up and their profits are okay. So Dillard's is a bit of an outlier, though. You know, they have not radically changed their trajectory. Penny's is harder to understand because they are now owned by Brookfield and Simon. So the only thing we know about Penny's, we'll come back to Penny's in a second, so I won't spend too much time on it, Penny's traffic, according to Placer AI, is down about 30% year over year. So it's hard to imagine they're having a great year. And Simon, in the recent earnings report, talked about the poor performance at Penny's. So I think it's pretty clear the top three are not performing very well. Dillard's a little bit better. And then last little statistic here is if you compare those four chains' traffic relative to 2019, down in the vicinity of 20%.
And they weren't exactly lighting it up year over year.
They weren't. So back to what? Not even back to 2019, which to your point was not exactly a banner year. So yeah, not very promising.
All right. So there we go. Another A. Now let's jump to, and you mentioned them, JCPenney, which again was one of my favorite social media quotes that you had, thoughts and prayers when Mark Rosen took over from from Levi's in the news.
I'm such an optimist.
You are. But your prediction, JCPenney takes over the mantle as the world's slowest liquidation sale. What say you? Maybe it's come a little slower or faster than you thought.
Well,
what do you think?
This is going to bring my average down quite a lot. Maybe I can improve upon it. I'm going to give it myself a D. And the D stands for dumb. Because this was not, as a prediction, it's not a very good one for reasons I'll mention in a second. But the other problem is we don't really know how Penny's is doing. So, so it's hard to evaluate. What I had in mind, well, first of all, the world's slowest liquidation sale is Sears, which still isn't quite dead, but we're just about there. I think Sears is probably wrapping it up here after the holidays.
You've been saying that for 3 years.
I have been saying that for 3 years, but I'm really convinced it's true. But my thought was that Penny's was going to really then start to decelerate. And the biggest evidence of that would be store closings. And they have not closed any stores this year. I suspect they'll close some stores after the holidays, but they are not falling apart kind of in the mm-hmm. way that I anticipated. Mm-hmm. And the reason it's particularly dumb is they have the new owners, Simon and Brookfield. And those guys, and they bought the business for a song. They've got a new CEO. So it would be very unlikely that they would really start to unwind that thing as quickly as I thought. So in retrospect, even though I am very pessimistic on the long-term future of JCPenney, this was a dumb prediction to make, and it's clearly not happening, at least not
all
yet.
Right. All right. So let's move on to number four. The profitless prosperity of disruptor brands becomes under increasing scrutiny. This is there's a lot of people we talk to about this. You mentioned Dan McCarthy. There's a lot of brands, a lot of buzz, a lot of people pulled down in an overall downdraft in DTC stocks. I got to think you're pretty close to the mark here.
Well, I'm going to have to say this was actually probably a bit of an underwhelming prediction because things really fell apart for most of these brands. So I'm going to give myself an A+ because, well, you know, we started using this term wobbly unicorns because many of these once proud unicorns have fallen into the gutter or whatever visual you want to have.
Some of them are a little more less wobbly than others. I like that term wobbly because you know some of them aren't gone. They're still proud.
But things are a little shaky. That's the part I like about the wobbly part. As hard as it is to say, I think in our outtakes we'll have to how many times we had to
blooper reel. That's the blooper reel.
Wobble wobbly wobbly. But here are four brands whose stocks are down more than 80%. Year to date, Allbirds, Rent the Runway, Real Real, and Stitch Fix. We have Warby Parker, Peloton, On Running, and Wayfair, which are down between 60 and 70%. So, very high profile brands, lots of venture capital money that have gone, public in the last year or so that have really taken it.
I mean, to be fair, if we're just looking at stock price, there's a lot of stocks. Like I could say Disney is down significantly and so is Target. So it's not the only indicator, I would say, that's pointing you in this direction, though, right?
It is not, but I think the thing which I was really pointing to in the beginning, it was less about making predictions about the stock performance because, that's always, to your point, it's you get caught up in other things and there are timing issues and things like that. But the profitless prosperity that I was alluding to is this idea that while their sales continue to grow pretty strongly, their profits are getting worse. And, that's generally not a great indicator, and that phenomenon would get more attention. So it's gotten more attention from the market, and that's driven their prices down a lot, but also just more and more people are talking about that. And we're seeing layoffs at places like Warby Parker and Allbirds as well. So the balloon has really been deflated here.
All right, number five, understanding buying versus shopping becomes more important. Well, if we rank this one simply on how popular this episode was, it was one of the most popular episodes of the year for us, our episode on buying versus shopping. But for the folks who may not know what that means, unpack that for us and then give yourself a grade.
Sure. Well, the quick description, and it is a little bit overly black and white, but it's this idea that we're kind of in two modes of shopping generally. Or consumer behavior. One is buying mode, or some people call it more like task driven or running errands, where it's very much a functional thing. It's about speed, convenience, acceptable choice, which e-commerce is particularly good at. Efficiency, right. And then shopping is more experiential, emotional, solution oriented. There's a lot of sort of adjectives that go along with that. And that's where certain kinds of physical stores are particularly important. And my point, which I made originally in my book, Remarkable Retail, but also we talked about on the podcast, as you mentioned, was that understanding this was going to drive more decisions, that this difference would get more visibility. And I have to say, as much as my ego says I would love for that to be true, I think it's true in a fairly, I still think it's an important distinction. And and I've had some experience with clients that really like it. And I've heard some people get back to me and say, when we heard this or read it or whatever, we really like it. But I wouldn't say that I can point to a ton of specific examples. Mm. So I'd have to give myself maybe a B- on this, which might be a little bit charitable.
Well, I think you certainly added the conversation, right? I used to talk about, this, and we talked about it together, this bifurcation between experience and efficiency. And that isn't always helpful when you're trying to put a strategy together as a retailer. What do you mean? And can't you be both? And all these things. So I thought it added to the conversation. So I'd, I think you're a harsh marker on that one. I think, as a prediction, I guess, if you're looking at it from, has everybody adopted this whole framework and has it improved? I think we've moved the needle forward. You've moved the needle forward. So I think you're...
Well, you're being very kind. I think my biggest issue here is I should pick predictions that are actually not so confusing to grade if we're going to do this assessment.
Some demonstrably simple statements. Well, let's talk about the next one. Amazon double clicks on its physical dream. So Amazon kind of toed and froed. A very busy year for Amazon in a whole bunch of ways. Where do you settle out? You visited their style store. You had that experience, but...
Yeah, you know. this is a real mixed one in that, but I think I would have to give myself maybe a C+. I mean, it is true that they opened two Amazon style stores, which are new concepts for them. And there are indications that they will be opening some more. Mm-hmm. They opened, they're up to 40-something Amazon Fresh stores. And they opened several more Amazon Go stores. But it's not exactly a breakneck pace. And so so we know that. We know they closed what I affectionately refer to as the land of misfit toys. Their books, their book concept and Amazon Four Star and things like that, which I actually think was a positive in terms of focusing on physical store concepts that can actually be scalable. So I didn't look at
And you've made the point several times in the podcast that you applaud that. In other words, don't keep it going on life support. If it doesn't work or does work, make the call, close it down, didn't work, move on to something else, right? I mean, you would applaud that, basically.
Yeah, I think having a culture of experimentation, that's the way to go. If anything, I think they probably held on to a couple of those things too long. So getting that focus, I think, is great. But the reason why I would say I can't give myself a very high grade is they're clearly not stepping on the gas, at least not yet, in terms of Fresh, Amazon Fresh in particular. Way more up in the air right now than I thought going into the year.
Number seven, the great reconfiguration gains momentum. So to your point about making more simpler projections, what are you talking about?
This is also something I talk about in my book, and we did do a podcast episode on this. But this is this idea that we would move, that retailers would move from more of a one-size-fits-all format strategy to create both more hybrid formats as well as a more hybrid go-to-market strategy. And I think, I probably give myself a B+ on this because I do believe we're seeing quite a lot of activity from some number of retailers. So we talked about Target already, not only creating these hybrid store formats to deal with the physical and digital world, but also pushing on smaller store formats, these sortation centers. And so this mix of physical assets to improve their success on a city-by-city basis. Best Buy has started to invest in testing this in a North Carolina market. They just opened a virtual shopping store. A lot of moves around smaller stores to complement larger stores on the part of many retailers. So I think this is definitely picking up speed. And I expect it will continue to. It's not as widespread as I thought might happen, or frankly, as I think needs to happen. So that will tamp down my grade a little bit.
Well, the next one, number eight, Metaverse Schmetaverse, actually is the most simple and easy to understand because it's the nonsense around the metaverse. Goodness. When you look at if you just ranked it in terms of how much pain it's giving to Facebook in terms of write-downs, or sorry, I should say Meta, right there, there's something. But what have you seen any light of day on this metaverse stuff, or what are you thinking?
Well, I still really feel more or less the way I did going into the year. There was so much hype around this and so much discussion, everybody with their metaverse strategy. And I just thought, well, it's interesting. I believe the metaverse will be important in the future.
Whatever that is.
But I didn't think anything of any real consequence was going to occur this year. And not only do I think that's almost exactly right, but yes, to your point, the biggest investor in this has really run into a wall, though I guess they're going to keep trying to blast through that wall like the Kool-Aid guy.
Made Jim Cramer cry. I think that was going to come.
Yeah. I mean, if you can make Jim Cramer cry, then, you've had a pretty good day. So, yeah, I'd give myself an A on this. And again, it's not to say that this won't be important. This is very much a test and learn kind of thing right now. But in terms of it really moving the dial on anybody's P&L or being, you know, most customers don't even know what we're talking about when we talk about the metaverse. And so that's not a ton of progress.
This is the next one, number nine, and we're almost there, is one you could kind of predict year in, year out in one way, shape, or form. Hyperbole becomes the greatest thing ever. Because there's always hype in the market one way, shape, or other. But what? Why did you think this was important to bring up
last year? Well, this is another poorly formed prediction. So I think, you know, even though I've done these prediction things for a few years, though I did skip 2021 because of COVID, and I was just like, I don't know what the hell's going to go on.
Predict anything.
Yeah, so my, you know, so I just bailed. I was a coward when it came to 2021 in particular. But
who can predict the Spanish Inquisition, by the way?
Well, nobody expects it, that's for sure.
Nobody expects it.
But no, I guess I said this partially to be try to be funny, and it came nicely after the metaverse prediction. But what is interesting, and I know we've touched on this in a few episodes and have talked about this with other people, is, you know, just the, you know, e-commerce is taking all over, you know, over the world. You know, nobody's going to shop in stores again. I was reading, which touches on the final one a little bit in a second, you know, e-commerce through grocery stores is going to double in 2 years, and, you know, which is not remotely close to what's happened. So there's just a lot of hyperbole, bright, shiny objects or whatever that seem to get a lot of traction among, you know, the punditry class or whatever, or the media. And I just think, you know, I'm a bullshit dispelling enthusiast, I think is the term that I used recently. And so I just think it's important that we try to let a little bit of rationality and facts prevail every once in a while.
You give yourself a double A on that or a double
sure,
B?
Sure, whatever. I think maybe incomplete.
I don't know. All right. No. Incomplete. Go to the back of the class. All right. This brings us to number 10, convenience wars jump the shark. And this one's interesting for me because it, you know, I long had debated or looked at, like, over the course of my e-commerce career, which is as similar to yours, like 20 years, how important getting something really fast to someone is. But this is like, what do they call it? Instant commerce. I think you were talking about here, but
yeah,
tell
that
me
was...
about what you're...
That was the main thrust. So the quote I have, which I just love and I've repeated many, many times, is from my friend Seth Godin, is the problem with the race to the bottom is you might win or worse, finish second. And I always felt that, well, first of all, how many things do people really need in half an hour, right? It's like, if you want to, if you really need something, they have stores, you know, you could go get it. To engage in a really expensive methodology of getting things to customers quickly seemed to have relatively limited utility from a consumer standpoint. But what we know, at least in the current way of doing things until we can teleport things to you or something, is extremely expensive, you know? So we saw not only on the part of some pretty big companies like Instacart, DoorDash, you know, et cetera, making big plays for fast delivery, but a lot of startups getting a lot of venture capital money, and as well as big companies doing some of their own fast delivery. And, you know, for the most part, not only have some of these investor venture capital funded companies either gone away, they are cutting back their staff a lot, exiting markets, et cetera. DoorDash just announced a big layoff the morning we're recording this.
I had a good conversation with GoPuff's SVP of business, and I came away from it more impressed than I was looking at just the headlines. I mean, they're in like 500 cities now. They may be like, there may be enough room for one. Like they built this business on their business on a foundation of, you know, university and college towns, right? Get the kids something fast, and you know they're delivering alcohol, and they got their own private label pizza, which is really popular. So maybe there's a there, but I guess
I believe there, and I don't know what, you know, I can't put numbers to it. I mean, I believe there's always a customer segment that's willing to pay a premium price for convenience. And there are certain kinds of product types, you know, Chinese food or whatever for delivery. I mean, there's, you know, there's certain things that have a different dynamic. So it's not that this this segment won't be significant and won't be a growth segment. But so much money and hype have gone into this idea of ultra fast delivery. And for the most part, we're seeing either prices go up for this, you know, Whole Foods, you can't even get something delivered for at least in Dallas for without paying $9.95 now. And a lot of the bigger companies are kind of pulling back on this. And even, you know, things like curbside pickup and BOPIS have pulled mm-hmm. back quite a lot. So I just think this is another one where, or even if we look at what's going on with Amazon, which has doubled their capacity for fulfillment on a local market basis, you know, now are pulling back on that. So there's been a lot of investment in trying to shrink mm-hmm. the time of delivery. And most of that is not looking like the most sensible investment. So I'd give myself an A on this one as well.
All right there, Richie Cunningham, you give yourself an A on that one. See,
we should have the listeners grade me like this.
Well, of course, and just in case any of our listeners, maybe even the international listeners, don't know Jump the Shark, that's from Happy Days, the TV show, and one of the long-running shows when the Fonz was water skiing in his leather jacket, and a big shark came up, it was right in the jaws, and he jumped over the shark, and that was pretty much the end of the show. It was like the show was kind of done.
Right.
You know, I think you did very well, Mr. Dennis, in your
better game. Than I did in college, and that's all that counts.
Maybe you should stay in the prediction business. I don't know, pretty good.
Maybe. Now. Well, I will be making 2023 predictions next month. So stay tuned for that.
Yeah. So next month, let's leave it there. But let's remind everybody we've been renewed, and our great presenting sponsor is back, Market Dial, and we'll be in New York at the NRF show, and we'll be on the stage. So you're going to get a preview of some of the work and thinking you're thinking about, and then very shortly thereafter. And we'll be releasing new episodes, season 6, including a prediction episode. I'm waiting myself with bated breath to see what's kind of going through that head of yours.
Well, we'll see if I learned anything from my poorly formed predictions this year. Maybe I'll just do like 5, and that way I won't feel so compelled to stretch things out.
I like it. Anyway, all right. Well, great episode, and let's leave it there. If you like what you heard, please follow us on Apple, Spotify, your favorite podcast platform, so you can catch up with all our great interviews, including Hal Lawton talking about Tractor Supply's remarkable Life Out Here growth story. New episodes of Season 5, presented by Market Dial, will show up each and every Tuesday. And be sure to tell your friends and colleagues in the retail industry all about us.
And I'm Steve Dennis, author of the best-selling book, Remarkable Retail, How to Win and Keep Customers in the Age of Disruption. You can learn more about me, my consulting, and keynote speaking at stephenpdennis.com.
And I'm Michael LeBlanc, consumer retail growth consultant, keynote speaker, and producer and host of a series of retail trade podcasts, including this one. You can learn even more about me on LinkedIn, and you can catch up with Steve and I in person at the NRF Big Show in New York, January 16th on the stage, talking about what it takes to be remarkable with Container Store SVP Gretchen Gantz. See you in New York, everyone.